Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCellaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, June 3rd, 2007, and this is show number 99. Well, before I get started on the show today, it's time for the traditional What Did Allison Mess Up Last Week part of our show. Well, last week I reviewed a tool called Caffeine, which keeps your Mac screen from sleeping. I received a very polite email from Leo, who asked me whether once was not enough to review Caffeine, and sent me the link to my own show from only 6 episodes back when I reviewed it earlier. Either that's a pathetic commentary on my memory, or it shows you how cool I think Caffeine is. Well, anyway, Leo, thanks for pointing out the error. Let's get a word from our sponsor, and then we'll get into the big news for the week. If you drive a Honda or an Acura, and you live in the Los Angeles area, I guarantee that your life happiness would be dramatically improved if you just had Honda Bob do all your service on your cars. Imagine the peace and tranquility of sitting in your easy chair while Bob slaves away in your driveway, working on your engine. No more visits to the dealer where you sit in badly designed 1960s orange plastic chairs reading People magazine from August of 2003, or worse yet, watching Oprah with all the other pathetic people waiting for an eternity for their cars. You also get peace of mind because you know Bob will do a good job, will explain clearly what he did, and he'll even show you what he did if you like that sort of thing. Even if you don't live in the Los Angeles area, you can still gain benefit from Honda Bob by reading his website at hdabob.com. In there, you'll find great explanations how different parts of a car work so you can be educated when you talk to the mechanic of your choice. Well, this was a very exciting week for me. I had the opportunity to attend D5, the 5th year of the All Things Digital Conference, hosted by Walter Mossberg and Kara Swisher of the Wall Street Journal. Walt is probably the most influential tech journalist in the United States. His comments have been known to cause 20% rises or drops in a company's stock, depending on how his review went of their product. This is my 3rd time attending this amazing conference, but it was just as much a thrill this year as it was before. It's a very small event, like 300 to 500 people, at a hotel in San Diego, California. The size of the event allows unprecedented access to the titans of the tech industry. They just hang around chatting with attendees. The other thing is I was able to get a front row seat for virtually every event also. In the lobby, HP set up a huge display. It was like 30 feet across and it was a touchscreen. And it used what's now being called multi-touch technology. What this means is you can use 2 fingers to do things like stretch and shrink photos, but also more than one person can interact with the screen at the same time. It was a lot of fun to play with the photos. We could sort of flick them and they'd fly across the display to the other person. And then later on, they set it up as a pong game, which was really fun. I got to play against an HP guy. I think he let me win. But the whole time, I couldn't help thinking how far the industry had come that we could now play a game from 1972. It was fun, though. At dinner, I enjoyed the company one night of David, Stuart, and Charlie, and we engaged in a surprising discussion. Stuart and Charlie are both experimenting within their companies with using Second Life as a way to hold conference calls. I was intrigued by this and questioned how this could possibly be a good thing and why would they even think to do it. Well, they said the ability to make gestures during a meeting can enhance the discussion in a conference call. By the way, you have to make or buy gestures in the program, like pounding on a table or hand waving. You have to buy those inside Second Life. Well, Charlie said that the way a true face-to-face discussion creates so much more bonding between people than a telephone call or an email, he said that that kind of thing can be partially developed through Second Life meetings. David asked the two of them whether they actually felt that this was a successful exercise yet. Like, are they actually conducting real meetings in Second Life? And they both said no, that it's still a novelty, but they're trying to see if it can be a useful tool. I thought that was pretty interesting. Well, on the second day, they showed a video best of from D1 to D4. And imagine my surprise and delight when they showed me asking Ivan Seidenberg of Verizon about Bluetooth. You may remember this from 2 years ago, but I'll tell the story anyway because it's one of my favorites. So Ivan Seidenberg was blathering on and on about how Verizon had just surpassed 10 million customers. Well, after his interview, they opened up the microphone to questions. Verizon was still, at that time, disabling Bluetooth on their cell phones, which was irritating just about everybody. So I went to the open mic and asked him, "When are you going to start offering Bluetooth on your cell phones?" Well, at first, he didn't even know what I was talking about. So Walt had to stop him from answering the wrong question, and he kind of quietly explained to him what Bluetooth actually was. You know, "Oh, Ivan, it's like where you wear a headset, you know, it doesn't have any wires." Well, that was funny enough. But then once he understood the question, he said, "Well, we're not going to do that." Can you believe that? The audience was like, "What?" So anyway, I said, "Well, then should I just leave?" And he said, "Yeah, you should just leave." So Walt looks over at him and says, "But then you'll be down to 9,999,000 customers, won't you?" Anyway, Walt told me later that day that it was his single favorite part of the conference that year, and I guess he meant it since they put it in their best of video this year. I love that. Well, Steve Ballmer was interviewed, but you know what? He didn't really say anything. It was weird. I'm serious. I asked several people afterwards what they thought of his speech, and at first they said, "Wow, he was, yeah, you know, he was great." And I'd say, "Really? So what did he say?" And they'd get this kind of blank look on their faces and couldn't come up with anything. Everyone did remember that he said repeatedly that Microsoft is enthusiastic and committed, but none of us could remember what they were enthusiastic and committed to. At one point, Walt started teasing him about the Brown Zune, which is possibly the ugliest piece of electronics ever made. It's actually, if you'll excuse my French, the color of poop. But to make it even worse, they put this lime green border around it that just takes it over the top to the realm of hideous. So Walt's teasing Ballmer, and Ballmer says, "Hey, we have cornered the brown MP3 market. We're going for the dirt bike crowd." I thought it was good that at least he could make fun of it. If you don't believe me on how ugly this thing is, I put a picture of it in the show notes. Well, the time with Ballmer was not completely wasted, because outside of his interview, he brought a guy to demonstrate the Microsoft Surface. This is actually really cool. In its current form, it's like a big coffee table, where the surface is a really thick piece of plexiglass, maybe like an inch or two thick. The entire surface is a touchscreen, which uses 5 infrared cameras from below to sense objects that are on its surface, including your fingers, but also other devices with chips in them. Again, this is that multi-touch technology I was talking about on the HP screen. He started the demo by authenticating himself with a credit card by just throwing it on the table, and his library of photos became available for pinching, spinning, and he actually played videos that could be manipulated the same way as well. He did mention that other people do have this multi-touch technology, but that no one else is actually shipping a real product with real applications. Microsoft plans to sell this initially to hotels and casinos with some specific applications they've developed. For example, he showed how you could throw down an ID card and it would allow you to gamble right on the table, taking credits from your account to apply to the games. He also pointed out that you can stand on this surface, pour drinks on it. It's really indestructible. In the hotel example, he showed a jukebox application where he showed a series of album covers. You touch the album and it zooms up, and then you can flip the image over and drag a song out of the list on its back and just drag it over to the jukebox icon and it starts playing. T-Mobile has also created an application that'll help you pick out a cell phone in their store. He laid a phone on the table, and instantly the table showed us how much it costs and some of the specifications. When he added a second phone, it instantly compared the features between the two. Then he chose one phone and then added services to them by dragging them from a list and onto the phone, and then it created an invoice. It was a really neat interactive method. Walt kidded around with Ballmer about how that's going to work with the chains they keep on the cell phones. And he said, "Well, now they're going to have a chain on the Microsoft Surface instead." So, Well, those two applications were pretty cool, but the two things the guy doing the demo did next were really spectacular. This guy pulls out a Wi-Fi enabled digital camera. I think Kodak makes these. Anyway, he took a picture of Walt Mossberg and Steve Ballmer together. Then he simply set the camera down on the surface, a ring formed around it, and instantly the photos from the camera flew out onto the surface, including the one he had just taken. He threw some special effects on it with a flick of his finger, then he flipped it over and addressed it to an email to a friend and sent it off. This was really crazy. I mean, it was very, very impressive. Next, he took 16 square pieces of glass and he threw them out on the table. Instantly, a video puzzle formed on them. Each one was a piece of the puzzle, but of course, this puzzle is pretty challenging because the picture keeps changing. It's really hard. When I played with this during a break, the guy told me there's actually a chip embedded in these plates, but it's so small you can't see them. They're just clear glass plates. The puzzle was really, really fun. And if you put it on the hardest level, some of the pieces have to be flipped over to be right. That's really annoying. Well, surprisingly, they don't have immediate plans to market this to the public. So most of us believed, we all thought there'd be a lot of interest in that. Word around was that it was on the order of $15,000. But, you know, if that's right, that's not completely out of the public reach. Heck, people paid that for a television set these days. Not me. Some people, though. Anyway, I'll be watching the development of the Microsoft Surface to see where that goes. That's for sure. I'm going to jump around a lot here. There's some people who spoke that I just didn't find that interesting, so I'm not even going to tell you about it, in case you're thinking I'm going step by step through every single thing I heard. Well, Jeff Hawkins of Palm demonstrated a little device called a Folio. That's F-O-L-E-O. It's a companion device to a smartphone. It's not clear this is going to be useful to people, but the problem it's supposed to solve is to provide you with a full-size keyboard and a reasonable display without carrying a full laptop around. You carry your smartphone everywhere, right? But what if you could have a big display and a keyboard with it? That'd be kind of cool. Well, it syncs with your smartphone over Bluetooth, so you pair the two together, and that means that everything you're seeing on the Folio is actually also on your Bluetooth smartphone. So any emails you send and receive using the Folio are shared identically between the two devices. Probably the most impressive aspect of the Folio is that it's instant on and off. And I mean instant. I was able also to toggle very quickly between applications. It not only does email, but it also will open MS Office attachments, and you can even edit and create them using the product DataViz. The Folio runs under Linux and uses Opera as its web browser, which is only limited in speed by the speed of your wireless connection on the smartphone. The Folio has a 10-inch screen, is less than an inch thick, but the darn thing weighs 2.5 pounds, which, I don't know, that's not that heavy, but it felt very dense when I first picked it up. They sync today with the Palm Trio. I know you're shocked since it's from Palm, but they do both the Palm OS and Windows Mobile 5 phones, and they said they think it will work with anyone's Mobile 5 phone. But they also said the tools are open so that anyone can create the interface to other phones. Specifically, they said someone else could make an interface to RIM's BlackBerry, but also that RIM could do it, or a third party, or perhaps Palm would do it themselves. The Folio will be $499 and will come out this summer. I think it's an interesting idea, and there is a problem there to be solved, but it's too heavy, a little too thick, way too expensive, and too limited in the phones it supports. If it were $200, weighed a pound, and worked with a BlackBerry, I think I'd get one right away. Next up, Walt Mossberg interviewed Steve Jobs. They danced around the iPhone, but since obviously Steve wasn't going to spill any details, there was no real news here. He said they have a saying around Apple that it's an odd ship that leaks from the top. Walt asked for verification on the statement that the iPhone will run OS X, saying, well, you don't mean the real full OS X or even real Safari, do you? Steve said, yeah, it's real OS X. He said that if you strip out all the data from OS X, it's not really all that big. So if you eliminate things like languages and desktops, it gets pretty small. That was good information, and he did let it out that they probably will open it up to application developers later on after they're sure they've got it stable and secure. Steve then announced that the Apple TV is now supporting YouTube. He was so excited about this. It's like a kid in a candy shop when he was showing it off. He showed how it's completely integrated into the interface for the Apple TV. So you're actually searching the web and looking at favorites and the top downloaded YouTube videos, but within all the nice, pretty Apple interface. You can't get to other places on the web, just to YouTube. He showed a funny video of a girl in a slingshot. I put a link in the show notes if you want to see what Steve thinks is funny. Then he showed another video. Then he showed another one. Finally, Walt puts his hand on Steve's arm and says, we kind of really got to start moving this along. At that point, Steve says, man, since we got this thing integrated in the Apple TV, we can't stop watching this stuff. To which Walt replied, is that why Leopard is late? That's a great line. There was also another humorous moment when Steve admitted that he is not the author of the fake Steve blog. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a very clever blog that is supposedly written by Steve Jobs. Steve did admit that he reads it and he thinks it's pretty funny. You can check it out yourself at fakesteve.blogspot.com. In another demo of something I think is not going to take off, Jason Calcanis showed off a human-powered search engine called Mahalo. The problem they're trying to solve is how often you really can't find what you're looking for on Google. They claim that a relatively small number of searches account for a huge percentage of the total search. They want to capitalize on that by having humans creating the answers to the most common search terms and providing the answers back in more relevant categories. Problem with this idea, of course, is that it still means that 20% or more of your searches will never find anything at all on Mahalo. They mitigate this by giving you the Google search results below their own, so you haven't really lost anything by going to Mahalo. In their demo room, I tried 7 search terms, and I didn't get any hits on anything I asked for. Well, I even searched on podcast, and the only thing it returned was their own podcast. The guy did explain to me that they only have about 4,000 search terms generated so far, and they hope to get it up to 40,000. Can't imagine how they think they could keep this relevant, even with an army of people behind it. George Lucas was at the conference and demonstrated some of the technology they use to create the latest Pirates movie, specifically the Maelstrom, which is a whirlpool out in the middle of the ocean. These two ships get into battle as they swirl around this Maelstrom. It's a really exciting scene, and I gotta tell you, while watching the movie, I didn't once think about the fact that that's an animation. Suspension of disbelief is fairly easy for me, though. He also talked about how, in traditional gaming, they're limited by the processing power of the game box, so certain things will be animated in only a few specific ways. For example, he showed a piece of wood being hit by a flying R2-D2, and no matter how it was thrown at the board, it would pretty much always break the same way. He explained that with their new technology, they're able to adapt on the fly how the materials will react depending on how they're impacted and the materials properties of the two elements. He showed Jar Jar Binks encased in carbonite, and he threw R2-D2s at it, and depending on how it was hit, the breaks would happen differently. This was a live demo, by the way, so he was able to change the material to glass and it would shatter completely differently as it was hit in different ways. Likewise, he changed it to rubber, and it would bend and sway in different directions from different impacts. He also talked about the changes to the characters themselves. He said they're adding artificial intelligence to the characters, so the reactions to things are not entirely predictable. Sure sounds like science fiction to me. Well, the biggest event of the conference was when Steve Jobs and Bill Gates were interviewed together on stage. It's the first time they've been interviewed or been together since the 1980s, so it was a truly historic moment. They started out playing a video made, which was the last time they were together, from 1983, which is a spoof of the old dating game. In this game, Steve Jobs was the bachelorette, well, you know what I mean, and the three contestants were Bill Gates, Fred Gibbons from Software Publishing, and Mitch Kapoor of Lotus, the makers of the 123 product, if you remember that far back. Well, Mitch Kapoor was right behind me when they played the video, which was kind of fun, and I've chatted with him before at the conference. Anyway, it was a really funny video just to see these two guys so young and being so silly. At one point, Steve asked a question of Gates about how he saw the relationship. And Gates in the video said Microsoft expected to get half of its revenue from Apple in 1984. I put a link in the show notes to the Macintosh dating game if you want to see this for yourself. The interview was oddly touching. It was a feel-good moment, believe it or not. I asked Walt about that afterwards, and he said that both guys had asked what kind of tenor he wanted for the interview. And he had suggested that since it's the 30th anniversary of the first mass-produced computer, the Apple II, that they talk through the history and where they see the future going. Walt at one point mentioned that a lot of people don't realize there was Microsoft software in the Apple II. And Gates started to tell the story about how they put floating point BASIC in the Apple II. But Steve grabbed his arm and said, No, let me tell the story. Let me tell it. He said, this guy Woz was writing this amazing BASIC. It figured out all your problems, but it was fixed point. So I'm begging him to make it floating point, but he never does it. He even designed it on paper, but I have no idea why he never did it. But Microsoft had this great floating point BASIC. Gates laughed and said that, hey, I got paid $32,000 to write that software. Steve talked about Gil Amelio, the former CEO of Apple, and he said Gil had a saying, Apple is like a ship with a hole in the bottom, and my job is to get the ship pointed in the right direction. Uh-oh, wonder why that didn't work. Walt asked Steve to talk about bringing the relationship back with Microsoft, and he said something interesting. He said that a lot of people thought that one company had to lose for the other one to win. But Apple didn't have to beat Microsoft. They just had to remember who Apple was. Then he said, Bill and I have patched things up. And Bill said that having the Mac business unit be allowed to have a special relationship with Apple was very important and that it's a great business for them. Sure glad to hear that. Walt asked Steve if there was something he regretted, that he could have had a much bigger market share if he'd done things differently. Steve said, you know, I made mistakes, but you have to look forward. When I came back, I gave the entire museum to Stanford because I said, you've got to look at where things are going to happen, what's going to happen going forward. It doesn't help to wish things had been different. Kara Swisher asked, what's most misunderstood about your relationship? To which Steve quickly replied, we've kept our marriage secret for all these years. That got a big laugh. Later, Kara asked, what one thing did they wish they'd had early on in building their companies that they saw in the other person? I really like Bill's answer to this. He said, Steve's sense of taste. He said, I'd work on projects together with Steve, and I'd be suggesting some engineering-minded solution because that's just the way my brain is wired. But Steve would just know what people wanted. He even called it magical. Thought that was a pretty amazing admission. Bill said he missed some of the people in the tech industry who didn't stick around. He said it's nice to work with people who've seen the waves up and down and are willing to ride it. He really implied that he enjoys the continuity of the relationship with Steve. To that, Steve said, when Bill and I first met each other, generally we were the youngest guys in the room. See, I'm only 6 months older than Bill. But now, we're the oldest guys in the room. That's why I like being here. He then said he was reminded of the Beatles song that said, you and I have memories longer than the road that stretches out ahead. A hush came over the room as that sunk in, and then suddenly the audience rose and gave them a 2-minute standing ovation. It was really a magical moment. I'm really glad I got to be there to hear that. The next three interviews were really intertwined. First with Chad Hurley and Steve Chen, founders of YouTube, followed by Philippe Dumont, the CEO of Viacom, and then finally Eric Schmidt, the CEO of Google. They were intertwined because virtually all of the discussion in the three interviews was surrounding Viacom's lawsuit against YouTube and Google. I grew bored of it after a while, But the bottom line was that Google and YouTube say they're putting in technology to allow copyright holders to identify their own content and gain revenue from the postings. And Viacom says that Google and YouTube are not doing nearly enough to protect content creators. The only good part of all this was the introduction of the Viacom president, Philippe Dumont. It was done by Stephen Colbert. I simply cannot do this justice describing it. You have to go see it for yourself. So I put a link in the show notes directly to that video. In it, he does a great bit on the iPhone. I think you'll enjoy it. Ironically, Kara Swisher came out later and announced that Comedy Central had called and demanded that they take down that video of Stephen Colbert. That was kind of weird. But on the next break, she came back out and announced that it was all a misunderstanding and it was put back up. It's pretty funny that that happened, specifically when the whole interview was about how Viacom is demanding that Google and YouTube take down these videos. Rob Glaser of Real Networks got on stage and demonstrated Real Player 11, which is due out at the end of June. I know a lot of people hate Real Player for some reason, not really sure why, but I had lunch with Rob at last year's conference and he was a really nice guy. He asked me a lot of great questions about podcasting and was very down to earth. Anyway, the big deal about Real Player 11 is that it integrates into your browser to allow you to download Flash video. So picture this. You're watching a video on YouTube, like the one of the three-year-old doing a Rubik's Cube in 114 seconds. I put a link in the show notes, of course. That is an amazing video. Anyway, you wish you could easily download it and do something else with it. Well, we've talked through a ton of different ways to do this, but let's face it, they're all kludgy at best. If you have Real Player 11 installed, when you start playing a video on YouTube and you hover over the video, a button shows up that says, download to Real Player. Easy as that. You don't even have to wait for the video to completely cache to your system before it can start downloading, and you can even start more than one simultaneous download. They said that Real Player will work on all kinds of video download sites, and that if the provider includes any kind of copy protection, it will not circumvent that, so you won't be able to download copy-protected content. He demonstrated it on the Mac and the PC, so I'm optimistic that this is going to be pretty cool. Rob clearly believes that this non-copy protection download will keep them out of the courts, but I'm betting somebody's going to sue him about something sometime somewhere, right? Well, I had a great time at the conference. It's a tremendous experience to actually get to talk to the titans of the tech industry. I learned a lot from them, but I also learned a great deal talking to people like David Roth, Stuart Sutton, and Charlie Brenner, who I would put in the normal mortal category. We had lively discussions, and David was a great source of information when I didn't know who people were or why a particular inside joke was funny. Plus, he saved me a seat in the front row every day. Thanks, David. Sure hope to see you again soon. The conference also allowed me to really enjoy my new camera, the Nikon D40 with a 70 to 300mm zoom lens. This digital SLR is really amazing. It's one of the lightest SLRs out there with fantastic performance, and the camera's only $600. I took all of the pictures from the show by killing the flash and then setting it to ISO 1600, which compensates for the lack of light. I was amazed at the clarity and quality of the photos, not grainy at all, even though I was pretty far away and the lighting was really low. This is a good segue into some tool discussions, which I promise will end up with photos of the show. Bart has been helping me learn how to use an interesting tool to create web albums of photos. I can't put my finger on the problem that this tool solves and the way it goes about it, but it has been an interesting experiment. The tool is called PHP Web Gallery from phpwebgallery.net. Unlike a simple install with drag-and-drop capability, this tool is actually something you install on your web server, and you create a MySQL database to feed it. The advantage of this method is that you can throw pictures up, and they're automatically entered into the database. That means you can create virtual categories with meta tags, and then the photos can exist in more than one category. Let me give an example. You could have vacation pictures that included a picture of a deer, but the same deer photo could be in a category called animals. The viewer of the web album can look at your photo galleries in many different ways, even sorting them themselves by date or by name, for example. The disadvantage of this method is that it's really, really, really hard to do and to use. I know Bart finds it a snap, and I suppose listeners like Tim would see it as an obvious way to think too. Their brains are just wired the same, and that same is not like mine. They talk PHP and Perl, all this nonsense to me all the time. But you know what? For me, it's not intuitive at all. As if creating a MySQL database weren't hard enough, the interface is really tough to follow. For example, first you upload a batch of photos. The next thing you have to do is tell it to create thumbnails. Well, I'm kind of used to tools doing that on their own, but all right, I can work with that. It defaults to only creating 5 thumbnails, even if you put up 50 pictures, so you have to remember to change the option to all. Next up, you synchronize. Really? That's not what I would have guessed next either. But okay. But again, the defaults are odd here. You have to switch it to do all files and folders and tell it not to perform a simulation. What? Well, it turns out this software is just recently coming out of beta, so this is a remnant of when you might want to simulate an effect before going ahead with it, I guess. Once you've done all these obscure things, you can actually see your photos. Oh, wait, no you can't, because you named them like a normal person with spaces between the words. PHP Web Gallery won't tolerate that. All the file names have to be named with underscores or dashes or something like that instead of spaces. So go back and rename all your photos, redo the thumbnails, and synchronize again. Wow, that worked! Oh, wait, the thumbnails look good, but the photos to which they link are huge on the screen. Oh man, this doesn't do any resizing of the photos to make them fit on screen. Well, I happen to have Photoshop Elements, which will resize a batch of photos for me, so I set it to make them no bigger than 700 pixels wide and let her rip. It did it pretty quickly, but then I had to rename my photos on my hard disk before uploading because I renamed them inside the web gallery the first time. Well, the good news is that when I upload these photos again on top of the old ones, the PHP web gallery adjusts perfectly to the new photos with no work on my part. I realized then that the photos will not sort properly, because what I wanted was them to be ordered by their creation date. But of course, I just lost the creation date because I created new versions of the photos when I made the 700 pixel wide ones. Triple arg! Okay, fine. I went back to the photos and I numbered them in PHP Web Gallery so that they could at least be sorted by file name. But for some reason, it doesn't work. I only did a handful of photos before I tested it, but it put the photo that started with 310 ahead of the one that starts with 156, which was followed by 154, which was followed by 152. Oh man, it's sorting in reverse order. There's no option to switch it. That's when I gave up. You really can't say I didn't give this a good college try now, can you? I learned a lot doing this, so I don't regret at all that Bart taught me, but this tool is definitely not for me. I put a link in the show notes to my PHP web gallery for D5 so you can see how that looks. But this is when I remembered Picasa Web Albums from picasaweb.google.com. First thing you do is create a free Google account if you don't have one already, and now you're ready to create a beautiful web album. Choose a name and date, add a description, and click on Upload Pictures. From there, you can upload them one at a time, but they even have software to allow uploading of a lot of pictures at once. I'm sure there's a Windows application to do that, but I happen to use the Mac for this one, and they have both a plugin for iPhoto and a standalone application, which is what I really like. I uploaded the pictures, then it asked me to give descriptions, which saved automatically, by the way, unlike PHP Web Gallery, for which I had to remember to hit submit, or all my changes on the page would be lost when I changed pages. I didn't have to resize my photos, I didn't have to create thumbnails, of course, I didn't have to create a MySQL database, and even the vertical photos resized to fit on screen nicely. In the thumbnail view, you can even hover over each photo, and it shows you the description on screen. And this does not use my disk space on the server, it uses Google's disk space. They give you a free gigabyte of storage. Icing on the cake is that they also give you a nice thing to embed in your blog, direct people to your album, which of course I've put in the show notes. I hope you enjoy my photos. I only uploaded 35 of them, but I took a couple hundred, so I hope you appreciate my restraint in only giving you 35. Well, now that you've listened to my excitement about the All Things Digital Conference, you can go watch all the videos online at allthingsd.com, or you can even subscribe to them as a podcast over at iTunes by clicking on the link in the show notes. Thanks to Leo for finding that. I hope you enjoyed this week's special episode of the NoSillaCast. Remembering that next week is show number 100. I'll be hitting that great landmark, I believe, the exact same week as TWIT. I do love to get your emails, so please keep sending them on to allison@podfeet.com or send audio recordings to NoSillaCast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.